Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 18th, 2005. This session is a continuation of the forum Uncomfortable Neighbors, Vecinos Incómodos, being presented in Creekside by Jim Tiffany and Rosemary Lopez Tiffany.
I thought a lot about it. It was in a Peace Corps. We were in a teacher training program, and one of the things that it was rural elementary school teachers in the Dominican Republic, so it was a lot of these schools were out in the jungle, you know, 4 hours on the back of a burro to get in the jungle to the little local schoolhouse where there wasn't anything to be seen around but jungle, and the kids would come out of the jungle into the schoolhouse, and, you know, teacher would open it, and we'd have school. And so one of the things we thought was just scandalous was how often the teacher would arrive late. Kids would be sitting around waiting for him to come and open, unlock the school, and they'd all go in. It's one-room schoolhouses. And so, of course, we thought that was a scandal, and we set out to teach teachers to be a good role model and be on time, open school on time. And that was just an absolute failure. There was no way we could. Nobody had watches in that society, so how do they know what time it is anyway? So, but I often, it was interesting how we could count on the kids. We'd get out to a school 4 hours out there, and the kids are sitting around, and I'd sit with them for a while, and then at some point they'd get up and leave. And I'd say, well, where are you going? They'd say, well, the teacher's not coming. Well, how do you know that? Well, because he's too late. Well, how do you know that? Nobody had any watches or anything. How do you know that? Well, they always knew, though. They always did, in fact, know. And so it was interesting because you learned to count on the kids. When they got up and left, I'd leave, too. Because I knew the teacher wasn't going to show up now. So there's some kind of a sense of time that doesn't have anything to do with the clock. And Rosemary and I don't want to say conflict, of course.
I used it.
Conflict. we do have our discussions over that issue. Because I grew up with this idea that time is this arrow, you know. Here comes a second, look out, there it is, boom, never come back. You know, that's it for that one. Here comes another one. So, but the Latino sense of time is something different. I'm not sure what shape it takes. Maybe it's a spiral or something, you know. Here comes a second, don't worry about it, you know. Catch it on the way back, you know, or whatever.
Gotta come back.
So it's interesting because it's a source of a lot of conflict. When I was at the health center, I was the director of a health center for a while. One of the people who was most upset about this was the dentist. The dentist is dentists are very dependent on time. They chug a lot of people through. And you have to be on time or else, kind of thing. And so the dentist came up with an idea. He came to me and said, he's really irritated with all these Mexicanos that are always coming late for their appointments. And so he said, but I have a solution. I said, oh, great, what are you going to do? He says, well, anybody showing up late, I'm going to make them wait an extra 15, 20 minutes. And I said, you think that's going to... You think that's going to do it, huh? They're going to... He says, that way they will learn by having to wait. They will learn not to show up late. So I said, oh, great, go ahead. So just a few days later, he came back all disgusted and said, that's not going to work. I said, well, what... you know, what'd they do? He said, well, they just sat there and waited. I said... Mexicano can outwait you any day. They'll just sit there and wait because time is no big deal. You know? So this man was just so furious and irritated, but had no way to address that issue. So what we try to tell people is to find a way to relax about it. Rosemary gives me healthcare lectures, you know. Your blood pressure's going to go up, you're going to lose more hair, you're going to get upset. You know, it's about the only thing that's going to happen if you want to be on schedule. You know, your other alternative is to loosen up about it, stretch your time frame, as we say, plan things in the longer stretches, make them more than one stage so that you can catch up at stage two if you didn't get stage one done on time. You try things like that. You try, one of my strategies doesn't work anymore, which was to tell Rosemary that the meeting is 8 o'clock if in fact it's 8:30, you know.
And I fell for it for a long time.
She did. She was, she caught on to me there recently, though, so I'm going to have to come up with something else now.
But we went to a session, a presentation we made at a school, and there was a PE teacher, and he said he was married to a Latina. And he says, and this time thing, and it really, really bothers me. He says, and I want to know what suggestions you have to fix her. Mm. And we just laughed so hard.
Hey, you're
fix
on
her?
Your own there, man.
You want to fix her? And he says, yeah, I want to teach her that, she's in the United States, and it's very important that she's on time, and I want my kids to grow up knowing that time is really critical. And we said, it is important. Time is important, and especially if you work for some big company or any place, actually, that expects you to be there at 8 o'clock. And, that's your responsibility to be there at 8 o'clock. And so, of course, you want to teach people, or you want to help them to understand that they need to be there on time. Because for some companies, time is money. And if you're late, just a little bit, it can make a big difference. So we just basically say, if you really want that person there at 8 o'clock on the dot, you need to let them know, I expect you to be here at 8. That's all you can say. But time is different. It really, really is different with Latinos. Even just crossing the border, going over into Mexico, you feel it. You physically feel the difference. All of a sudden, it's like your whole body relaxes, and the further in you go into Mexico, the more laid back that I think it feels. It has a real good feeling for me. Everything seems to move a little slower. No one's rushing you to get anything done. But it is, it was a big deal in our family because I think that at times when I was supposed to meet him for something and I was on my way, I quite often be late, I'll be honest. And when I'd get there, I'd try to explain to him the reason why I was late. And, that was my apology. And yesterday we talked about apologies. And there's no such thing as I'm sorry. And so my I'm sorry was the explanation to him as to why I was late. But he wanted to hear the I'm sorry, but I wasn't saying it. So he was really irritated, and I couldn't really understand what was bugging him. Because I had explained why I was late. But later on, I understood he needed to hear the I'm sorry.
But now I know she doesn't mean it, so
that doesn't make a difference. And the other thing that really was kind of an issue for us is when his family said they were coming over to visit, they could be in Jamaica flying in over several days and tell us, we're going to be at your house at 1 o'clock. And by golly, they were there at 1 on the dot.
Well, worse, 12:45.
Yeah. Oh, that was so like, oh my gosh, 15 minutes early, I'm still cleaning.
Rosemary, I always thought that was cute.
I thought that was so cute. They were really on time. Here they are. Geez, I can open the door at 1 and know that they're going to be right there. That was so funny and so cute to me. Because in our family, my family, when my family's only 2 hours away, they're not in Jamaica, but 2 hours away, and they'd say, well, we're coming over and we'll be there at in the morning, and you try to pinpoint morning, 10 o'clock, fine. So I tell Jim they're coming at 10, Jim gets up, at 9 to fix breakfast, and I'm like, you don't have to worry about that, let's just wait for them to get here. And then at 10, they're not there, at 12 o'clock, he's pacing the floor, at 1 o'clock, he's going, they're not coming, and I'm like, yes, they are, they'll be here. 5 o'clock, yep, for sure, we better go off and go do our own thing, because they're not coming. And 7 o'clock, there they are, and I sit there. I told you they were coming. And he's like shaking his head because he can't really believe, that they could be so rude and say they were coming at 10 and not show up till 7. And I guess when you think about it, it is a little rude, but...
It's rude to us.
Yeah. Would it be rude to not be there? Let's say they could come at 3 and you guys...
guys. I mean,
because
their expectation is save the whole time till the end.
They probably would have gone off and gone shopping
and that's
come
happened.
Back, checked for you.
That's happened. They've come or gone because we waited and thought, well, something happened, they didn't show up. I've learned to just go with the flow, you know. So we go do what we're going to do anyway.
And
come back home and there they are.
Our door's always open anyway. I mean, and so they just come in and watch TV, make food, you know, do their own thing, go shopping, come back, check on us. So no one's upset about it except except Jim, who's thinking, how rude. But, you know, he's adjusted to it.
Her brother was 45 minutes late to his own wedding.
He was out getting the chicken.
And the only person upset about the whole thing was me.
Church full of people.
We're there
Jim's
at this
like,
church full of people.
Jim's going, he's not coming. He ran away.
And so I, you know, at about the 10-minute mark, you know, I got up and started pacing, everybody just sitting there. And I got up pacing around, looking around. I went out to the parking lot. There's a bunch of guys out in the parking lot, you know, who were her brothers-in-law. They're all sitting there around the car. What's going on? Where's Johnny? You know? Oh, he went out to get the chicken. You know, I mean,
the
bride's in there
and
dressed
and
waiting, you know. And so Johnny pulls up. Hey, here's chicken. Okay, yeah, that's cool. Oh, you know what? I forgot a tie. So everybody, you forgot a tie. You know, so I was all uptight about that. But I, like I say, I was the only one. Nobody else seemed to think that was
so
a big deal.
It's sort of, it's a fine line between a cultural thing, but it tends to become like a moral issue. Like, you know, whereas it's just a completely different worldview, but it's so entrenched in certain cultures that, you know, it's immoral practically to behave differently. So it can be a very judgmental kind of a thing.
Oh, yeah. It would get that way. I know in this group, I mean, you've talked a lot about encouraging Mexicano participation here. And I know that would be right at the top of the list of issues that would come between you.
And this brings back a lot of memories of when I lived in the Philippines. I was there for 6 years. Uh-huh. My family. Very same view of time in the Philippine culture. And a lot of Western Europeans, Americans, North Americans living there. And they have adjusted to this, this difference in the concept of time. I was remembering, you said arriving minutes or hours late for an event. And we would say, oh, the Romaldos are giving a party. Okay, what time is the party? It's at 7 o'clock. Okay, it's a Philippine party. So since the Filipinos are giving it, that means we don't get there until 9. And if you got there at 7, this would be terrible.
Yeah.
Would be there, they'd still be getting ready.
Yeah.
So even though an invitation says 7, then you get an American couple giving a party. What time is the party? 8 o'clock. Oh, it'd be there at 8 o'clock.
Right.
The dinner party especially. You know,
right.
Time. And we went to the Union Church of Manila, and this is a North American run church, so the church service starts at 9, you're there at 9, because but the Filipinos came at 9 too. Mm-hmm. They know if it's a European North American event, mm-hmm. that means that it's a different rule applies.
Uh-huh.
But if it's a Filipino event, you have
that
rule.
2 hours.
Well, that's good there,
people,
just
people
the
translate.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Translation.
That's
right.
Worked out very well.
How does that impact specific things like mealtimes, like meals?
Mealtimes?
Yeah.
You mean in a family setting? Family situation?
Yeah.
Like Rosemary?
I don't know. Well, we had a large family, and my mom would say, you know, dinner's at 5 or whatever. And if you showed up, if you were there to eat, you ate, and if you weren't, it's your problem. She wasn't going to get up and cook anything extra. If there were leftovers, get yourself the leftovers, and if there weren't leftovers, then you wait till breakfast the next day.
But
you know,
five
didn't really mean five.
Yeah, five.
You know, five meant
four,
six.
Five.
You know, or even seven.
Yeah.
But the thing was that dinner was going to be served at some point, and you know, you came when she called you, and if you didn't, that was your problem. Yeah, there wasn't anything else special for you.
One of the things we talk about is relating to time is to teachers. When we talk to teachers, we talk about detention. Yeah. Is detention effective for Latino students?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Really, what you're doing is you're just punishing yourself. You're having this Latino kid sit in there, and I mean, he can outweigh you any day. He'll just sit there, you know, and because time is no big deal to him. But to the Anglo teacher, she's just furious, you know, mm-hmm. thinking she's really getting this kid, you know. It's the other way around, you know.
And at schools where you have conference, you know, parent-teacher conferences, those are only 15 minutes, you know, back, or 15, 20
yeah.
minutes, and they're back-to-back. I mean, you schedule them so tight that you've got to get them in, get them out, and I still can't comprehend why we give a 20-minute conference. I mean, you would think that no one gives you just 15, 20 minutes, you know, that's it. But anyway, they are scheduled that way, back to back, and it's really hard because what we have found in the past is that if one of the families is late, then it puts your whole schedule out of wacko. I mean, it just puts everyone behind, and you can't, I mean, some people are really offended, you know, by that. Some people who are used to the schedule and coming in, you ask them to come in at a certain time, and they have jobs they have to go back to and so forth. So some people are pretty upset by it, and usually what I find is that my Latino parents come in pretty slowly and don't really get there on time. And so what I try to do is just say, you know, I don't have any more openings today, or I have an opening an hour from now if you'd like to come back, or if you'd like to wait, but I do have an opening an hour from now, and usually they wait. They just sit around and wait for it. It's not a problem. And then other times they come in when, I mean, if the appointment was for Wednesday at 2:00, they won't show up, or they didn't show up. But on Friday morning, when I have kids, they show up, and it's like, what do you do there? Because usually, what they tell you is, well, I didn't work today, so I thought that I'd come in and for my conference, you know, without realizing that you're teaching. You have kids. I can't just sit down with you, but I do. What I do and what we tell people is to stretch your time frame. I go ahead and take my parents whenever they pop in, because I know that they made the effort. I know that they're being honest. They're saying to you, I didn't work today, and they decided to come in. I mean, which probably, by the way I interpret it, it is I Wednesday at 2:00 when I had my schedule, my appointment, I was working, you know. But I'm not working today, so I'm here. And so I usually take them anytime they pop in. I try to take them. I try to get some busy work for the kids, and I shorten my conference with them. But I do try to meet with them whenever it is they can pop in. But usually we tell people stretch your time frame. Know that, you know, the chances are they might come in a little late.
What about things like I was up operating forward in the snack bar. Maybe open to 4:15, 4:30. Do you understand my question?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Okay.
In this culture, when you say 2 to 4 in the afternoon, what they're hearing is in the afternoon.
Okay.
He's open in the afternoon. Okay, I'll just pass by sometime in the afternoon and check it out. You know, but the number doesn't stick in there.
So I can say in the afternoon and again after Vespers.
Yeah, you can do that and close when you want. You know, I mean, that's going to be okay too. They're not going to show up at 4:30 and have a closed door and get all mad. They're going to just say, oh, well, they're closed. You know, it's going to be no big deal.
Based on what you said yesterday, though, I bet if it's, you know, 4 and there's people in there and you're breaking the close, you would not say, Okay, you need to all leave now because we're closing. No, wait until everyone is done.
Yeah, you're stuck. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There was a salesman in Wenatchee named Antonio that I almost hired for El Mundo, but wasn't quite ready yet, and so he went and got hired by the local radio station. So Antonio goes out and becomes a pretty good salesman. He meets all his sales goals his first week there, and doing really well. Well, the second week, I see him back in my office. He quit. I said, Antonio, what happened? What did you quit for? He said, I couldn't stand that supervisor. It was a woman. And he said, she kept telling me about all these goals we have. Well, I'm meeting the goals. But I said, well, what, you know, she said, he said, it was the way I was doing it. She didn't appreciate how I took too long with all of the clients. Mm-hmm. Every client, he took way too long with clients. And her thing was 20 minutes and get out of there. And he said, his comment, yeah, exactly, that's what he said. He said, you can't even say hello in 20 minutes, you know, and he would sit and visit and on his own time go in early and have breakfast with people and find ways to stretch that visiting informal thing. And the guy became a really good salesman. But the Anglo supervisor couldn't stand what was happening to the schedule.
Yeah, and one of the things we talked about yesterday was taking the time to, you know, to just do the personal thing, to get to know, you know, like Jim said, a 5 minute meeting could stretch to 20, 30 minutes because you're taking time to just say hello and how are things, and it's just real slow to get started, to get down to business. But and that's too bad he had to be fired for something like that. But we also sat in on another interview where a travel agency, I don't know if you remember, travel agency asked us to sit in and help her to hire a Latino. They wanted to hire a Latino for their business. And so we sat through the interviews and we decided on this one guy. Seemed to be really on top of things, really, really with it, very knowledgeable. And we felt that he would fit quite well in there. And I think he did. He did, but then next thing we knew is she had fired him, and we didn't. She said, "Well, he was coming in late all the time.
Chronically late.
Chronically late." So we said, "Oops, you know, geez." So we asked, "Well, how late? What does that mean?" Well, he instead of 8 o'clock, he was coming in. What did she say? 8:02.
3 minutes. 3 to 5 minutes.
And we're like, oh.
And I just said, three to 5 minutes late. You would fire a really good salesman and representative for that.
She said he was good, but he was chronically late. And it was 8:02, 8:03, and she wanted him there on the dot. We just were like, you haven't met my family. She would have just, she wouldn't have taken.
So is that just an excuse? Is that just justification for it?
You almost think it
seems like
a
self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, we tried to hire.
I know there are businesses that are run that way, and it's not an excuse. And one of the, I worked as a consultant for a long time. One of the men I ran a company that I consulted with had a motto: 10 minutes early is on time.
Yeah.
Oh, he ran his company that way, and he figured that if you're not you're not disciplined enough to be there at 8 o'clock, 8:01, 8:02, 8:03, that's not 8 o'clock. So be sure you're there 10 minutes early if you want to be there on time.
That's
how your watch might be off a couple minutes. So. But that's just was his way of drawing a line. You know, this is separates the guys who are going to work for me from those who aren't.
Mm-hmm.
I think people have the freedom to do that, but I don't think you can pretend to say you're going to have a racially diverse workforce. Those are competing values, I think.
Yeah, and I understand this thing about being on time. I mean, I don't agree with it all the time, but but I understand it. I mean, you know, you have a job, you're expected to be there, you need to be there. And if you're not, then you need to be told you're not getting there on time. But 8:02, I don't know. Not especially if he was good. And we felt he was really a good guy. And so I don't know what, and you know, you may be right that her issue was something else. She just wanted to say, well, I tried, but it didn't work out. Who knows? So
let's move on to, unless anyone else has comments or questions about the issue of time.
I have a,
yeah?
This isn't quite time, but one of the things on your list on the right side was something that Latinos must likely to be, or is siesta? I guess that was something I was associating with my question.
Yeah. Yeah, work ethic and siesta, yeah. In fact, it's not part of Latino culture. The part that is strong is work ethic. And if you go to Mexico, what you will see, and Rosemary's commented on it many times, is, wow, everybody's busy here. Everybody's working. Even they're doing little humble things, but it's work. And it's not the traditional lazy guy dressed in white leaning up against a cactus. You know, that's just not the Mexicano at all. He's at work. And he has a strong work ethic. Any orchardist around here will tell you that.
Yeah.
You know, very solid, strong workers and not particularly interested in taking breaks and long lunch breaks and stuff like that. They want to work. And they're proud of it. And they one of the big reasons they come up here is this whole thing about how we respect our work ethic. They do too. They know that they can work 3 hours for $4 an hour and get $12. Wow, what a deal. You know, where they come from, that's not true. And so that's this bad rap that they get, we're not sure where it comes from. But some people have suggested it's this concept of tropical time, you know. We're in tropical countries between about noon and about 3. It's too hot to do anything, so everybody closes down. Shops reopen about 3 and stay open into the evening. And so typically, traditional Mexico, you would have dinner at 8, 9, even 10 o'clock at night. Well, the American tourist comes by at 2 o'clock, you know.
After sleeping in until noon in their hotel.
In, and everything's closed, and what does he say? Oh, these lazy Mexicans taking a siesta.
Yeah.
You know? So maybe that's part of where that comes from.
I heard the siesta in a negative impression. I was just referring to that there's more of an emphasis on rest or taking the time that you need, especially with meals.
Yeah, meals are extended. That's true. And it's visiting time and so on. It's just a more relaxed view of time, but not as far as work and siesta. I think Mexicans really respect a working person. Yeah.
Very strong work ethics. Yeah. I mean, you know, my in-laws used to work picking apples, and to them, there was an art to it, you know, to picking and thinning and pruning, because what it meant that if you did a good job, then the following year's crop was going to be very productive. And so if you were horrible at pruning or thinning, then, and like they would get people that, you know, young kids that would come in to pick, and the Latinos would be very upset because it was like, you know, these guys are messing up our crop, you know, very strong work ethic, very, very strong. And they you know, that's why a lot of the foremen, a lot of the orchardists would hire the same families over and over again because they know them. They know their work ethic is strong and that they're not going to harm the trees or you know, your crop is going to be even better the following year because of that.
Comments?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just wondering, this isn't to put a value on, or good or bad on either way of doing it, but if, say, Holden has a pretty structured time thing, why would Latino families for vacation time want to subject themselves to that?
Excellent question.
I mean, it sounds like it's so, I mean, I seek no time constraints on my vacation, but I doubt that people would seek time. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a good question that you need to ask yourself again. in your own work groups here, you know. But in, I was thinking about conferences and meetings and so on that Rosemary and I go to. If it's a Latino organization or Latino run, the schedule is one way. And if it's Anglo run, the schedule is quite different. Typically, the Anglo run is shorter blocks of time, very regimented, few spaces for doing that. And the Latino run group is larger blocks that are not really real well defined. A lot of fuzzy zones in there, and plenty of time for just that's open. What they call open, but it means where you can just go hang around and do whatever you want. So it's a very different concept. Somebody else had a yes.
Just on the subject of vacation, because I don't know, for me, a lot of the Latino time sort of seems like the vacation time where it's more fluid. You sort of arrive when you're able to or when you want to, and then maybe not drift out as badly. But so is there the Latinos' time that just their time all the same, whether it's working or vacation or meetings? Or is there a more relaxed time for vacation, or how does that work? Is there a vacation sense? When you take a holiday, do you
I think it flows kind of naturally, and it's a little difficult for us Germanic types to kind of get into that. But I go to when do we get together? Easter, for example. Rosemary's family likes to get together for Easter, and they go to a park. And so my first anxiety is, when are we going to leave? To get there on time, Well,
there isn't a time.
Whenever. We'll get there. We're all going to go, and they'll agree. We're all going to go to this park, and we'll see, and usually they say a time, like 1 o'clock. And so we're lucky if we leave at 1 o'clock to get to the park, but nobody cares. Everybody kind of dribbles in.
Somehow you make it there at the same
you do
time.
Your activities in such a way that you don't really depend on a specific number of people being there. You just, whoever's there is fine, and you just hang out and visit. That's the top priority anyway, is interpersonal relations, not the organized activity. That's not the priority. Once everybody gets there, then, it's time for the organized activity. So then we have the Easter egg hunt, and then there's barbecuing going on, and well, looks like enough people are here. Let's go ahead and throw the food out,
See, and when I went to Jim's
that's how it works.
Family reunion, it was like,
oh come on,
I was so tired because it it's 9 o'clock we're doing this
okay,
at 10 o'clock
that's
we're doing
volleyball
this.
Game okay
at 11 o'clock
volleyball game's over everybody move
and I'm like. Can't we just do nothing? It was really structured. It was, and I think maybe that's the word to use. Is there's more structure in it, and the expectation that you will be there at 10 o'clock for the volleyball game or whatever it is. Whereas the family reunion on our side, it was just as he described. At some point, we all agree that, okay, maybe 1 o'clock is the time we're going to be there, but not really,
They don't say that, but they act that way.
But everyone's going to aim for 1 o'clock, but it may be that you get a few families and others might come at 3 o'clock or 5 o'clock and join in, and that's okay too. No one's got, a big deal about it.
I'm trying to think of how we here at Holden, I'm especially looking forward to Oviedo Camino, when we have two settings of meals. They're really quite rushed. We have the first setting at noon for lunch, and the next setting at 1:15. And I mean, we come in and put the food on. The food's already on the table, and we eat, and then we have announcements, and then we kick everybody out. And I'm trying to think of a way where we can accommodate, either pushing one back or pulling one forward. Coming in and sitting down and eating and talking and asking about your family. And I'm not seeing a solution. Does anyone else have some suggestions for that?
Yeah, I'd say maybe you could, if you're sitting with people, you could encourage them to take a conversation outside or something. feel free to stay associated with each other and keep it going. But I don't know, maybe
that's you know what that sounds like to me?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
You did
it's
all
just
the
a
phase.
It's a suggestion.
Yeah. Yes, there's
more of a base, certainly.
Yeah.
I think one of the highlights, most favorite meals that I've had over the 5 years, no matter what week it is, has been the Fiesta meal, which is a buffet. There's music going on the Ark. It lingers and lingers, and somehow it's suddenly worship time. You know, and yes, we did do the dishes, but I think maybe we could look at a little bit more of a buffet line. But I don't actually recall, and maybe it's a little bit related to, you know, how you adjust schedule in both directions. I don't recall a lot of hassle about dinners at noon, you know, in terms of people recognizing that they needed to come. I think the buffet meals are more enjoyable. They're probably more enjoyable in general in terms of pace. One of the things in terms of the feedback as we try to me, one of the gifts in Abuna Caminos is that we really have a committee that helps to make this plan. So it's not necessarily just Anglos trying to figure out how to meet some of these things. And one of the things that's clearly emerged isn't so much that the class shouldn't be at 9 o'clock, it's not having such a heavy schedule. And wanting the afternoons to be free. And so we've been really trying, you know, fewer teachers. They didn't like having conflicting things being held outdoors to have the craft class out there on the porch and made it visible. Some of the poetry writing was on another porch. So the ability to visually see that you can wander in and wander out. You know, I don't think that we can completely into a different sense of time and still get the meals on the table and all those sorts of things. But it didn't, I don't know, Jane.
Well, I just had kind of an aha this morning earlier when you talked about the whole present and past focused, that the whole concept of an Abrienda planning team is somewhat of an oxymoron, perhaps, for the folks that we want to most engage to help us plan, which also has just helped me understand the way the meetings have gone. Where this, you remember worship, and we did this, and we did that, and we did that, rather than, okay, but who are we going to have as teaching staff next year? You know, I mean, that some of the flow is making more sense to me now. As well as the fact that I think more of the folks who come to those meetings have been in the U.S. a little bit longer, you know, have made those cultural adaptations, and yet are still very much connected to folks who are newly in this part of the Pacific Northwest, who are again primarily from rural Mexico. So it's been
one of the factors that you're gonna run into is the desire to please you.
Yeah.
The desire not to disagree.
Yeah.
And even though in their heart they know that that's not going to fly, they're going to say, well, they want it this way. And you're going to get a lot of compliance, even though it's somewhat forced. Mm-hmm. But it's because they're very respectful of you and don't want to challenge you and will go ahead and do it your way.
Does that tie in with the inferiority of conflict?
Yeah.
Conflict.
Yeah, that's what we wanted to talk about that a little bit anyway before we have to go, but the inferiority complex thing is not something that's not something that Rosemary and I just came up with. This is something that's been discussed and has been in Mexico now for probably 60, 70 years. 1934, Samuel Ramos is the philosopher, Mexico City, who wrote about the Mexican character. And his whole thesis was that the Mexican character is determined primarily by behavior to overcome a feeling of inferiority. And especially when faced with the mighty gringo. And this is Nobel Prize winner Octavio Paz also talked a lot about that. He supported Ramos in his statements that that Mexicans are feel when faced with the gringo who stole half their country and who beats Mexico economically all the time and who wins in the movies. And, you know, every time they get together, it's another loss for Mexico in their minds.
Except for soccer.
Yeah, except for soccer. Well, yeah. But, and it's, this is something that they themselves feel. And Rosemary and I wanted to test this out when we were in Mexico, and we were invited to a literary circle. These were authors, poets, writers, administrators, you know. I didn't feel like I even belonged in a room. These were real intellectual types. And we sat around a big oval table. One of the things they wanted us to do was to read poetry in English. They just wanted to hear it.
They didn't understand English, but they wanted
hear
to hear the language.
What it sounded like, you know. So we did read some poems, you know, and that was interesting. And then we had a discussion period there, and I asked a question. I said, "Is it true that Mexicans feel inferior to Americans?" And they all just kind of matter of fact said, "Oh yeah, that's true." And I said, "Do you feel inferior to me?" And here are these guys, I mean, these very capable, intelligent people, having accomplished far more than I have, are saying, "Yeah, we do." I mean, that's tough. That's tough for us to think of that. It's Mexicans coming up here with a huge chip on the shoulder, thinking that you think that you're better than they are. And that's such a, it's very difficult to deal with, that chip on the shoulder. And it's, you trip on it all the time, especially when you have to correct somebody, change their behavior, scold somebody, whatever. It's automatically, it comes out, "You Americans, you gringos, you think you're better than we are." And it's very difficult to deal with that.
I grew up in Las Vegas, and there were quite a few Latino youths in gangs, and I'm wondering if that ties in with that, the resentment of gringos and then acting out against that.
I think that, you know, the gang...
Is there a corollary?
You know, the gang thing to me is not... it's not traditional Mexican.
Okay.
At all. It's interesting that so much of it is a Latino problem. Rosemary and I like look at that a lot, and I think we relate it more to the breakdown of the family. Family breakdown for immigrants coming in, and all of a sudden not having all of those natural breaks to their behavior, the culture and the family and the friends present, and so they create a new family, which is the gang. I think that's probably a better look at it than the other way. I think, you know, Rosemary and I have talked a lot about it, and I think this reaction to feeling inferior is kind of like the machismo thing. You know, that's where I see the macho Mexicano, and especially the Chicanos. The Chicanos who are born here in the United States are very challenging people, and very likely to look you in the eye and stand toe-to-toe and do all that, whereas the Mexican from Mexico is a lot less likely to do that. I mean, he's going to avoid your eye contact, he's going to agree with you, he's not going to want to argue with you, and stuff like that. Because, you know, down deep in his heart, he believes he's inferior to you. And that's tough.
So asking...
That's really tough.
Asking, what do you think, is not real enough.
No. What do you think? He's going to say, you're the boss, you tell me. You know? Or... You're asking me this to trick me somehow. You're putting me down.
You can't win.
Yeah, you really can't.
And it all depends, too, on how you ask it, how you ask or how you make a statement. If you're a female in a, you know, in a higher position, or if you're younger, older, all of those things fall into place. And sometimes what happens, especially with middle school, high school kids, you know, they tend to get really angry at their teachers for no reason, really. And it was all maybe something the teacher said that created that, you know, that just kind of upset him, because he already has that complex about you thinking you're better than I am. And so, you know, just on how you said something might tick that person off so much that they built a lot of anger and resentment towards you. And sometimes the teacher or person doesn't know why you're upset. And it sometimes doesn't have anything to do with you. It just is that inferiority complex that they're dealing with, that they don't know how to shake off, how to get rid of.
The classical comment on this comes from Porfirio Diaz, who was president at the time when he said it. He said, "Pobre de México, tan lejos de Dios y tan cerca de los Estados Unidos." And he said it when he was the president of the country. He said, "Poor Mexico, we're so far away from God and so close to the United States." You know, I mean, that's the belief all the way down from president to peasant. They believe that the United States is a real problem for them because it's full of people who think they're better than they are. You know? And they come up here and they go to work for us, or they participate on your committee, and there they are, you know, thinking to themselves, you know, these people think they're better than I am. And that's the starting condition, you know. And I mean, we didn't do anything. It's not your fault. I keep telling myself, it's not my fault. I did not steal Texas. You know, I didn't do it. But there's no way for me to say to Juan and Pedro and Jose that, listen, I'm an okay guy here. I'm not the bad guy. I don't think I'm better than you. There isn't any way for me to counter that. You know? It's very frustrating. Anything else you want to say on that before we get to that yellow handout?
I think just being real honest with people and dealing with people around here, being real honest, they can really recognize a fake real quick. They know if you're just messing with them. So we always say just be honest, you know. And for, you know, for teachers, and I think last night we had a few teachers in here, is you know, just don't dumbify a lesson for them, or don't dumbify anything for them. I mean, treat them like you would treat other people. They can really, they don't expect less, I guess is what I'm asking of people.
And if you have a chip on your shoulder anyway, and feel that the teacher thinks she's better, how about when the teacher says, "Do you understand?" We went through that yesterday also. Do you understand, or do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, the immediate reaction is, what, does she think I'm really stupid or what? So that chip on the shoulder just gets in the way of her.
And I know sometimes when Jim and I are not understanding each other, it's something he said to me really, you know, this chip that I had really just kind of began to irritate me.
What do you mean had?
I don't have it anymore. But, you know, just sometimes in the way he says things, you know, like, I think, well, you think you're better than I am. I mean, it naturally comes out. And, you know, and then we begin to, you know, we both have to step back and think, oh, we are going through this cultural conflict here. This is really a cultural thing. It's not really a problem between us. It's just that culturally we're not understanding each other. So when you step back and you look at, okay, what did I say, and how did she take it? How did he understand it? And, you know, if we think back about our cultures, you know, she really thinks that I meant this, or he thinks that I meant that. You know, it really, we do step on each other's toes that way.
Yeah, once in a while, Rosemary will snap at me, and I'll go, what happened there? You know, and oftentimes it's related to that chip on the shoulder, that I said something that to me was totally normal and natural, and she goes, I go, what? You know, and it must be that she in her, she felt emotionally that maybe I thought I'm a little better than she is and I'm putting her down.
And it used to be if someone, an Anglo person, wherever it was that I happened to be at the time, said something to me that offended me, I think I went home and I actually snapped at Jim because I was putting everybody in that same category of, you know, you people think you're better than us all the time. And I'd like, you know, walk around mumbling, da-da-da-da-da-da. And I think, well, geez, he didn't have anything to do with it. I mean, it was a situation that was totally separate. But, you know, it does happen, especially if you're Tejano. If you're Tejano or Chicano or the more adapted group that's lived in the United States, they walk around like that with a big chip on their shoulder, getting very angry at you for no apparent reason sometimes.
This yellow handout's 2 pages that we'd like to take a look at before we finish. This has to do with the development of the Chicano. And it's very interesting that Kaiser Family Foundation does this every year. It's real useful to look at attitudes of immigrants in the country. It's interesting that one of the findings here on the first page is there's several findings, but fully half of third-generation Latinos say they have little in common with Anglos. That's after 3 generations. After 3 generations living in the United States, they still say they have little in common with Anglos. I mean, this is a barrier that we need to acknowledge and respect, you know? And that's why we're here. We're working on this thing. Most Latinos also say they have little in common with Latinos from different countries. Mm-hmm. And that's just amazing. I mean, no matter how many generations go by, you're a Guatemalan American, you're not a Salvadoran American or a, you know, a Dominican or a Mexican. It's amazing how persistent that is. Yes.
That's a problem on the East Coast where you have many Latino
yes.
groups and then administrators of organizations try and lump them all together. Oh, let's take
right.
a support group with each other.
Exactly.
They don't see it that way.
Doesn't work.
And they've said that clearly to us. You know, we have different traditions, different food.
Yeah.
And yeah. even and with interpreters too, and I don't know if you use
yeah.
them here, but
yeah.
interpreters being very cautious with that because you may think that you are pulling in an interpreter that knows how to deal with the Mexicano when in actuality you have an interpreter who's maybe an Ecuadorian and it's very different. And the people sense that and know that because there are some Ecuadorians who they tend to believe that they're a little higher up the ladder than Mexicanos, mm-hmm. than Mexicans. And so when they speak or when they deal with Mexican people, they do give off this feeling of, I'm better than you. And so if they're your interpreter, then the Mexican people right away become very offended by it. So being really cautious who translates for you and how they translate and who your interpreters are.
Our friend Jaime is Salvadoran, and he was telling us when he came... When he came from he left home from El Salvador to come to the United States. His mother has this talk with him about all these things, do and don't do, you know. And she says, son, you're going to do a lot of things that I'll have to forgive you for. But there's one thing I will never forgive you for. She said, don't you ever marry a Mexican. He's telling us that. What? I said, what? No, he said, yeah, that's... Salvadorans and Mexicans. I mean, it's
so
amazing how persistent that is, too.
So
yeah.
How would a mostly Mexican community that's gathered here, maybe can't speak for them, feel about a Salvadorian bishop doing the preaching here?
Yeah, that's true. In when actually we have a Colombian guy, and I don't know who else, but there's from different countries there. And... It's okay, it's within the church. that covers, you know, that covers a lot. So that's, you know, yeah. So we're okay there. It's when we get out of the church and into social gatherings and his conversation and so on, it will become clear he's not a Mexican.
And when you say church, do you mean Roman Catholic Church or a large church?
Roman Catholic Church. That's what I meant.
So if he's outside of the Roman Catholic Church?
No, it'll be okay when he's, you know, I assume
he's
Roman
status,
Catholic.
I think.
But when he's doing his official thing as representing a church, whatever that be, and the ceremonies that you have designed, that's all going to be okay. It's the rest of it is going to be the interesting part, where
it's the 23 other hours.
Yeah,
yeah. Right. But you know, and everything depends on the personality of the person. I mean, there are this Colombian guy in Wenatchee is very well liked socially, and so it all depends on, you know, on who it is. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I just think of the musician that we've been using who has a lot of cross-cultural experience. When he was an unknown quantity as a Puerto Rican, to many of our planners in this area, it was like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
But because of his experience and his way of being, it turned out to be fine. Mm-hmm. But that was not assumed that it would be okay.
Right. Well, I wouldn't do
it. As far as we know.
Until,
the first year he was not invited.
Right.
To be a musician because of being from Puerto Rico.
Right.
We wound up with a guy from Peru, you know, and somehow Peru seems more acceptable than Puerto Rico. I don't know what all that turned out. Not because of nationality, but because of who they were, the guy from Puerto Rico would be much better. So.
Yes, it all.
That's right. I forgot that his first year he was not invited.
It all goes down to respect, and this gentleman from Puerto Rico is probably respectful of Mexico and its music and people, and that shows, and that's going to get him in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. This chart that we have on the second page here, this is very interesting. We've worked on this at several different sources that we put this together with. On the left-hand column, the arrival group is pretty much the group that Rosemary and I try to describe here in our presentations. This would be the group that lives, born in Mexico, does not speak English, and decides to immigrate here to the United States. That's the arrival group. Their average education level, 6 to 9 years. They believe that religion is very important. Kids should stay home until married. That's traditional Mexican. The kids, even if they're 30-year-old kids, if they're not married, they should be living with mom and dad. That's where they belong.
And in a lot of cases, even after they get married, they come back and live with the parents.
Yeah, and there's no talk about kicking the kid out when he turns 18, you know. they just think that's just amazing how Americans can even think about kicking a kid out of the house. You know, that's just unheard of. Decision making is interesting. It's the husband when anybody's looking, and it's the wife when nobody's looking. You know. Most of them will agree that it's pointless to plan the future. But almost everybody agrees that maintaining culture is really important. Very strong attachment to family and the traditional respect issues that we talked about yesterday. Down on conflicts, we talk about cultural conflicts. The conflict is with the new society, with this group. They come in here and conflict is with Americanos. As they become adapted, you look across to the bicultural group. The conflict shifts. It becomes between parents now and children who are adapting faster and changing faster. So there's interfamily conflict that goes on because of that. And then shifting over to the right-hand column, the adapted group, the conflict is now, for these people, with the new arrivals. So you see Chicanos conflicting with Mexicanos. that come, and there's quite a conflict that happens there.
And that's hard to understand, but what we do have is groups of people who have been here and have never been to Mexico don't understand the kids that are coming in from Mexico and what they're dealing with. And so, to me, I always found it really kind of odd that Mexicanos gangs would fight Mexicano groups. You know, it's just like, why are we fighting each other? I don't understand that. But I understand, you know, as I study it more, I realize that those that have lived here forever don't really even understand the ways of Mexico and the people that are coming in. So, you know, there's a lot of misunderstandings, and they begin to fight each other just for no
reason. One of the areas that I feel like I have a sense that it's a factor, but I don't understand how it works, is around who's here legally and who's here not legally. There seems to be some collision within the Latino community around, and maybe it has to do with this last piece, I'm not too sure. Is there something there that is divisive?
I'm not sure that that's a divisive, because that's going to be true in most Latino families, certainly in our area, in Eastern Washington. Most Latino families are a mixture of legal and illegal members. Mom might be illegal, dad might be legalized. One or two of the kids might be illegal, the older ones they brought with them from Mexico, and the three younger ones born here are citizens. So there's often a big mixture of legal and illegal in the same family, you know. And so I don't think that sets up a conflict so much. But you may see, I mean, it's used in ways in the family that's pretty unsavory. A lot of men use this to control and dominate the women. We've seen many cases of women whose papers never get arranged on purpose. The men won't do it for them as a way to maintain control over them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
A form of abuse.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah. A form of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've got them. They've got them stuck there and afraid to move because they're illegal.
And it
aliens.
Scares them. They can't, you know, even if there's violence, they won't leave because, you know, where do you go? You're illegal. You can't get help. You'll be deported. Maybe your kids will stay here. Maybe your kids will go with you. And so it is. It is a real form of control, and unfortunately.
So if we take a look at this middle column now, this would be the bicultural group. These would be a lot of some Chicanos, but not all Chicanos. Some are foreign-born, some are U.S. About half are citizens. About 75% now are high school graduates. They still have a really high sensitivity to discrimination, and they still claim that discrimination is a serious problem. As far as religion, they begin to drift away from the traditional Catholicism. The wife now begins to play a greater role than before. They start to look toward the future now. They're not looking back to the past and present so much. They still say that it's important to maintain the culture. And here we see gang problems now. Attachment to family weakens. It says strong in terms of the immediate group, but of course they're here, and so all of those extended ties, great-grandma and Uncle Fred and all those folks, they're back home now. So they don't have them around anymore to be the natural break on behavior, and we've got gang problems now. In terms of respect, they're more willing to question you. They'll face you down, they'll look you in the eye. Chicanos are really known for that. Education continues to be the number one concern they have. In surveys you do about what concerns are facing your family, education always ranks at number one. That, however, they are more willing to question and challenge teachers and go to schools and complain and stuff like that.
they're more willing now to pull out the old credit card instead of pay everything for cash. And there we mentioned the chip on the shoulder. They become a little more challenging, maintain more eye contact. In terms of conflict, at the bottom, children often reject the culture of origin. This is so true. We see kids, and I did it myself. I remember when my mother came to school, and I just, I was so embarrassed. You know, I said, I don't know who that is. You know, why? That's natural. And the kids here reject mom and dad who look different and sound different and so on. And so, yeah, you reject that culture of origin. On the right-hand side, these are adapted now. These are the folks who are Latinos, but it's hard. The only way you could tell is by asking them, because they speak English perfectly. They act like Americans. Most of them are U.S. citizens and high school graduates, and they behave in many ways very similar to mainstream USA behaviors.
Let me ask a question that's been in the back of my mind all morning. I remember reading an article in, I think it was the New York Times, describing the percentage of Latinos who self-identify as, quote, white. Mm.
Uh-huh.
And this varied across the United States from different in Los Angeles than it was in Portland and in New York City. And I wonder if this adapted group might self-identify more as being in the white community.
Yes, absolutely. Down somewhere, at the very end, on conflicts. Strong desire to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
Very strong desire to be American. I mean, and they're gonna be more conservative than the conservatives. They're gonna be whiter than the whites.
Yeah, but
you know.
Yeah, but they don't identify as a different racial group, and I don't know where this starts.
No,
in the Latino community, and you know, is it in Mexico already, or is it in the first generation, or the second generation?
I think it's, you know, we know a family where the a couple of the kids embarrassed the parents. Immigrant family, Mexicans, by insisting that they were white.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had the situation where the lawyer didn't know what to do because you have to mark it on the little box.
Yeah, and I think it could be embarrassing for somebody to assume that they, you know, white, non-white, if you check, which box do you check? And sometimes often not a Latino box.
Right.
So,
right.
So, or in your own mind, do you think of people as a different racial group?
Yeah.
And is that insulting if you do, or is it insulting if you don't?
It's a problem. But your question as to where does it start, I think generally, I don't think it starts in Mexico. I think generally they see themselves as Mexicans, as different from white people, and not white. I don't think they think of themselves as white. But some of the, especially the kids, some of the kids with this very strong desire to fit in, to be like everybody else, especially growing up here, speaking English, not knowing much about Mexico, a lot of those people will call themselves white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And much to the chagrin of their parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any more questions about it? This is the Chicano group. Chicanos are Americans. And that's a whole different ball game. They're children of Mexicans, but they're very, very different. And one of the things the other day we were talking about Chicanos, and somebody asked, give me a characteristic that you feel is a strong characteristic of Chicanos. And the first thing came to my mind was anger. You know, and I think when I'm around a group of Mexicans from Mexico, I'm totally relaxed. I'm fine. I'm just sitting around telling stories, and we're talking, and at the barbecue or wherever we are, and I don't have a fear of anything. But if this were a bunch of Chicanos, all of my systems are on yellow alert. Not red alert, but I'm at yellow alert with Chicanos, because I feel there's a lot of anger there. There's a lot of anger with Chicanos. And I, you know, that was...
Yeah, they're more high-strung, ready to catch you at something maybe you said or that, you know, that offends them, and more willing to jump on it and let you know that they're upset.
Yeah.
But I kind of sense a lot of anger in there too with Chicanos. They're really not sure where they fit exactly. And so they're angry at everybody now.
There's a book I read just recently. I don't know where I found it, but it was like on the sale table or something. Mm-hmm. And the name of it was Why Black People Tend to Shout. I don't know if any of you have read this, but Ralph Wiley. It's just a great little book, Why Black People Tend to Shout. And he talks about black and white. He doesn't talk about the Latino thing. But throughout this book, a lot of anger comes out. And I related that to some of my Chicano friends who live in a society that's dominated by white power and white privilege, as we talked about last night. And it just, over time, it just, you get angry. You get angry about it. So, and I sense that anger in my Chicano friends. And, you know, I'm just a little bit more on alert around Chicanos than I am around Mexicanos. I don't think Mexicans, I don't think of them as angry people. You know, that's not anger. They're respectful and they have a lot of humility. And, honest, hardworking folks and here to make a living. You know, that kind of thing.
I feel like the sentence there is still kind of an elephant in the room.
Oh, yes. You do? Okay, you want to talk about that, huh?
Yeah. Don't forget the suggestions, too.
Yeah, we'll do that. This...
Elephant in the room.
This was just stuff that I was writing last night, and then this line here appeared this morning when we came in. And so somebody thought they were going to be funny and write that up there. But it says, your mother is very tasty. And... This would be a severe insult in anywhere in Mexico, and to any Latino or Chicano, no matter who you're talking to. You don't talk like in the black community, your mama jokes, those kind of, you know, that's just unheard of in the Spanish-speaking world. You do not talk about mom. That's it.
And then disrespect.
Oh yeah, that's a.
Mom is highly respected in the Mexicano community. I mean, just very highly respected, held on a pedestal pretty much, and you know, everybody refers to mom, and even the husband, who appears to be the one making the decisions, really relies on her for the final answer. So anything in reference to mom in a bad way is really cause for. For a bitter fight.
So we decided when we saw it this morning that, well, okay, somebody was just telling a joke or something. We decided that we weren't going to take it personally. So, but I don't know.
I appreciate your generosity.
I don't know what it means to anybody else or to who wrote it. Yeah.
Well, Jane told me about this
when
I wasn't here in the beginning this morning. My immediate reaction, and I'm still mulling this over, and because we've got lots of community members here, I'd like to share the dilemma. My reaction immediately is very similar to a few years ago when someone went into a guest room during Vespers and stole a wallet. It was shocking. It was against the trust that we hope to establish here. There's no peace here, etc. And I just found myself in that same place of, I mean, I do hear your generosity, but I'm deeply offended and embarrassed and angry. That was written by someone, and not knowing, as we didn't know in that other situation, was there need, was there, was was this a joke? Was somebody doing an English, you know, Spanish lesson? Or is it an intentional insult? But what I did in that other situation and what I'm inclined to do here is to acknowledge it to the total community that we as a body, need to confess that among us there has been an insult that was done, really, I see it as graffiti, that we need to take into our hearts how we hurt each other. And but I am Anglo and I like to do something about stuff. So, but anyway, I want to throw that out because I can't accept it.
Okay, I'm sorry, this might be contradictory, but I think the best response to this is to not do anything, because what this person wants is acknowledgement that they maybe, you know, offended someone. I think the best response is inaction and not acknowledging it, just completely ignoring the behavior and not giving them the reaction they want.
I would disagree with that.
Okay, that's fine.
Only because it's... I think whoever wrote that knew enough to know it was insulting. And I think the community needs to know that that's part of our brokenness and that that still exists. And I think glossing it over then makes it okay.
And I think, I mean, to me, it's so contradictory to our desire to be hospitable to anybody who gets off the bus. Mm-hmm. And so it's whatever it says to the person who wrote it is one thing. I hope that it says something to the rest of our community that that we don't know how to do this yet. That's still part of what we, I think, need to repent of. And I think if we don't say it, it speaks volumes to Imelda, who is here on our staff, who is, you know, the one Latina who is part of our community until October. And I can't imagine what it would feel like to be her when you two get on the bus and leave. And she's going to be here till October, when her aunts are saying, what are you doing up there? What are you doing up there with all of those people? You should be here with our family.
Well, I kind of took it as someone teaching a lesson. I mean, trying to, like as if they were teaching a lesson and was giving an example. I guess that's how I took it.
She's a very generous
school teacher. So, but yes. I don't know, your mom is, to me, says your mother is very delicious or very tasty or something. Could be very derogatory, you know, really could.
Well, it's the impartial lesson that was said, what you talked about yesterday, uh-huh. It's on so many levels.
I don't think there's any doubt that it's derogatory.
Yeah.
Rosemary's tends not to see...
I want to take it as someone doing a...
She tends not to get the little off-color joke a lot. No. That's why I love her, but this is definitely derogatory.
Part of my concern is because of the conversation about two that you said yesterday, was it somebody who was here, you know, and participating in this training? And in some ways, I don't know that it's there is a need to identify the person as much as it is this acknowledgement that we've got a long ways to go on to learn this respectful attitude that you're already talking about. But I if anyone else has any thought about this,
I don't disagree with what action you'd be taking with, but I do think, just as a previous high school student, this is the kind of thing where, not saying high school student, but just if someone walks into a room, oh, there's Spanish on board, I know a little Spanish, I'll write something funny. It's not a premeditated, I bet they're going to have that session again, let's see if I can piss someone off. So I think it's important that you acknowledge it, that it's not acceptable,
right.
But it's not malicious.
Yeah.
It's.